Good morning. Sometimes that's all I want to say. Good morning. But actually, there's more. Two weeks ago, before Barry's excellent presentation last Sunday and the Sunday before that, I'd been talking about suffering. Which seems to have layers. So rather than we're most overwhelmed by suffering when it becomes one great big one monolith, and then it can just, or a tsunami, and it sweeps us away. But if we look at different aspects and parts of it, it's very different picture emerges. So the first thing I talked about was what I've come to think of as suffering with legs, suffering that comes toward you. This is to say, circumstances, outside or inside, that produce a response of suffering in us. And I think of it as, I called it at the time, adventitious suffering, which is more of a classic Buddhist term. Advent meaning coming toward you. It says that kind of psychological and emotional suffering in response to pain, problems inside and outside, are very real, but they're not absolute. That's to say, the cause can change, and then the response can change. Right, so there's a suffering in relation to outer and inner circumstance. And I like the image of legs because the idea of it could walk away again. You could turn it around or you could do something about it. Sometimes what you can change is your response, but it is not in itself some kind of a fixed monolithic absolute, although it feels like that because it is so weighty. And that's often described in terms of craving what I don't or can't have, or resisting a fact of my life, aging, illness, loss, and clinging to what I have and fear to lose. These are states of suffering. I mean, they're very real, very powerful in our lives, but they're not absolute. We can often change either the cause or our response. And so we work with them. And then 2 weeks ago, I talked about the suffering of our delusory thinking, because the question is, why do we wind up in such a pickle, and such a painful pickle, so much of the time? So hemmed in and pressed. Why do we have this suffering feeling response, to things that happen? And the suffering of delusory thinking is that our minds, the way our minds work, leads us into dilemmas where we have suffering. It arises out of the limitations of the way our minds work. So I see what I call delusory thinking is all the thinking and ideas and responses we have that come out of our delusory or divisive ideas of who we are and what it means to be alive in the world. So, thinking gets us in trouble. And yet it's our birthright, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful. So this is what I was looking at last 2 weeks ago, where thinking is natural and good. It is what it is, a natural expression of humanness without which we could not possibly flourish as natural beings. And yet, when we think, we create divisive and delusory ideas like me separate from you, mine, yours. I want to reject impermanence. All these ideas. We make mistakes with our thinking about what's actually going on out there, and then we believe our ideas of how it ought to be. All those stories that we have about the ideas and plans about how it ought to be and how things ought to go, and then they don't actually fit with reality, and we suffer. There's a huge friction and discordance. So that's one level. We have ideas that really just don't quite work. All views, every single view we have. To have a view is to have kind of a fixed direction, even if it's sort of provisional. I think it's this way. Or the Dharma taken as a fixed teaching, of course, doesn't quite meet truly a world that's in change and flux and doesn't really listen to your opinion, doesn't believe in your opinion. So there's having a view, and then there's the belief in it. This is most of where our real trouble gets in, because we could theoretically say, okay, I'm having an idea here and I understand that it's an idea. But we move to believing it. This is how it is. This is who I am. This is what I have or don't have. This is what I need. This is what's wrong with me, with you. Those are belief systems that we create all over the place. And under that, the root of that kind of a delusory thinking is just the very fact that when we think, when we have an idea or a thought, we're already making a sort of a separate little thing there. It's easiest to see when you say what's in or not part or not part of a person. But even if I say brown, there are things that are not brown, and there are things that are brown. I've created a little box called brown, and some things go in the box and everything else falls outside. Seems fairly innocuous, but we do that with everything. And just doing that is already... The universe isn't divided naturally into little boxes. That's our little boxes, our little world. And that is what's called ignorance, originally. Gets us into trouble. But it's not wrong to have a me. This sort of doesn't even make sense to say it's wrong to have a me, even though there's a sense in which I'm going to make mistakes about what that is right from the get-go. I mean, my idea of what a me is and how it ought to be related to Queen for a day, every day. Right? So we do really skewed and sort of perverted things with the idea of me, and yet to have a me is natural and essential to flourishing as a human being. You can't really learn and relate without having a sense of me, and that's what it is to thrive as a human, to be an individual. It's a good thing, but on the other hand, we're already making mistakes as we set out. So what happens is that we experience ourselves, we have a divided self. Some form of that is a lot of what brings people to practice. There's a sense of being divided against ourselves, a sense of being divided from other people, from the world around us, from this sense of divided or incomplete. Sometimes it's experienced as wounded or suffering, and sometimes not. But this divided self that is central to our suffering and central to our lives. The Shakyamuni said the teaching wasn't easy right from the get-go. But it's approached in many ways, and the thing that I have found recently, the place that I want to go today, is Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet. In his eighth Duino elegy, one of his later poems, he's talking about the divided self, and it's one of the most beautiful statements of it I know of. So he's talking about how our minds and lives circumscribe us in words that are freeing, these beautiful poetic words. So he had when he was quite young, as a young man, had a tremendous success as a poet. World War I tore his world apart. Someone actually sent him to basic training. That they got him out of there. But he went to Berlin. He tried to understand what was going on. And what had happened in his early poetry, one of the beauties of it, was that he had an understanding of darkness as a place of wholeness. You know, as we have in the harmony of difference and sameness, we say the branching and merging streams flow on in the dark. Well, he saw a darkness in which there's richness and depth. And then he got to World War I, and he saw where in darkness was a place of tremendous destruction and despair and corruption, horrors. And he didn't write poetry for many years. It just it, that's my sense of many things. He was stopped cold in his ability for his voice. He had no poetic voice. He thought he'd lost it permanently. And it wasn't until several years after the war was over that he started writing again. And he wrote brilliantly for a few years before his death. So in this poem, he's looking at the conscious aware person divided from ourselves and from our world. He's contrasting this divided person with the animal freely embedded in the universe. He says, "With all its eyes, the natural world looks out into the open. Only our eyes are turned backward and surround plant, animal, and child like traps, keeping us inside as they emerge into freedom. That there is something out there we know only from the animal's gaze." He sees the animal embedded in its world, and therefore its gaze is from within to what it is connected to. It isn't looking from outside in or from inside out. It is part of the universe he's calling the open, and from within that they can behold the universe, where we turn backward and surround plants, animals, and children like traps. The traps on the boxes of objectifying the world, of saying that is a... And every child learns that. It's wonderful. It's not wonderful when the child can identify something, has a name and a word for it, because then they can relate to it and call it up. And they can also say it's not me. So this meet, that push and pull. Oh, yes, that's there, and it can come toward me. Or yes, you're my mother, and I can relate too. And then by the time they're two, it'd say you're my mother, and go away. You know, it's I need to experience me, and we have to do this. But we are setting ourselves apart, cutting ourselves apart. And if we don't pay attention to that, we are lost in it. With all its eyes, the natural world looks out into the open. Only our eyes are turned backward and surround plant, animal, and child like traps, keeping us inside as they emerge into freedom. Because, of course, once we create boxes, we are the captives of those boxes. So our beautifully delineated world, we get trapped in delineation in all these separate little categories. We become a category. We may think that everything else is a category and we are the thing that's three-dimensional and living and breathing is how it feels to us, but actually we create a universe of boxes and we are the captives in it. Can you follow an animal's gaze or find your way into some sense of what a plant's awareness is? We see their wildness. No, we don't actually want to be a wild animal. Remember that they also don't have their aspect of those lives, that they're not ours. But there's something in wildness that draws us very strongly. It was Elliot Porter, the photographer, who said that great in wildness is the preservation of the world. He was quoting Thoreau, maybe? In wildness is the preservation of the world. And then our generation, we get... was Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature. What wildness is left... We've chopped the whole thing up. We're so good at making those boxes and delineating the details and separating things out and then acting on it. Because what we see is that we act on that. That's not a mountain. That's a pile of coal. I'm going to take it and then use it for benefit, but I'm not going to go at the origin of that, I'm not going to see a mountain, I'm going to see a pile of coal. And so we have such a huge impact on the whole planet through having a divided approach. And yet, this is to be human. I'm not saying we should be somehow become aphasic and not make, not have words or not have categories, not have ideas. And yet, what are we going to do with it? Another one of our great Zen images is, although it's a, in that case about, is about you can't turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a ball of fire. This reality of how things really are is like a ball of fire. If you ignore it at your peril, but you try to go toward it, you seem to sort of burn yourself. What are we going to do? The whole of the Duino Elegy, he lays this out. Go further. He lays out the situation of the divided self. He does not propose a solution. He says, we are divided. This is the animal gazes into the open that it is embedded in, and we are apart, we are divided. And he goes through it in very interesting and beautiful ways. And the reason the Dharma is starts with the noble truths of suffering is that that's exactly where we have to start. With the fact of the divided self and the fact that that divided self is suffering. And why is it like that? And why is it suffering? And we're not going to somehow erase that, because the self will always be and needs to be an individual who can say, this is my mouth and that's food. And what are we going to do about the fact that there's two mouths here and only one piece of pie? How will we meet that crisis? That's where we start. And that's where we start almost every day. We sit down for zazen. The reason to have a regular practice is that we forget that we forget. We forget that we forget that we forget. We forget that we're a divided self. We're so busy running around in that. And then we say, oh, it's time to sit. And we sit down and we remember that we're divided. That's the starting point. Over and over and over. Buddhism didn't invent suffering. It just said, let's start with that. Let's pay attention to that. Because we can, because it's actually a very hopeful tradition. It says, because we can. Rilke doesn't say, there's something we do. He lays it out most beautifully. And then we have, where we have, instead of the backward turn that divides and traps us, we have Dogen's image of the backward step that illuminates the self. Which comes from, in a sense, from the great ancient image of the swastika. I was shocked the first time many years ago I saw a Buddha statue with a swastika on its chest. I was completely shocked, because this beautiful and ancient spiritual symbol was misappropriated and polluted, tainted forever for us by the meanings the Nazis put on it. They stole it. They took it. Away from its original meaning. It's a symbol of the turning of life energy, forward and backward. And the backward step is you take that movement of life energy and you move it inside. It's not stepping away. It's a pulling in. It's an inward motion that implies its resolution in the outward motion. So there is there's a Dharma transmission document that has the two swastikas. It's a very ancient document that we copy out in each generation. And at one step in that process, it describes a sort of a linear picture of this reverse swastika. You take the backward step to in which you can understand what the self is, the divided self, the undivided self, the roots, all of where you can see, but from within. You see, we're not taking a backward step away, as Rilke sees it. We're understanding that we're starting out divided, and then we sit down and say, in what way can I take a breath inward and come home to being home here in myself that's not cut apart? It's never a practice of detachment. Zen, in fact, all Dharma is not a practice of detachment. The practice of being present here and now. and cutting ourselves loose from some of our ideas about what that means and the practice of Zazen for that moment. Always comes, you know, just as there's an inhalation, there's an exhalation. Always that energy turns back out. As the other image that takes that same word backward is in is the, again, in the harmony of difference and sameness, where it speaks of the forward and backward foot in walking. You have a foot backward and you have a foot forward. That's what walking in is. There's always a backward step. But it, can we do that without turning away? Can we understand the backward step is the step for moving forward? That's why I like Kin Hin, which we don't do on Sundays. Our very, very slow walking meditation, in one sense, is just a continuing Zazen between two periods of Zazen. But in another, it's walking, it's enacting with your body that same settled state. But when you're doing it with your body, you're saying, oh, look, this foot is moving, pouring into this foot, which is pouring into that, and the forward foot becomes the backward foot, and the backward foot becomes the forward foot, not separated. Someone once, I remember Regal years ago, did a lot of Kin Hin behind me and said that I reminded her of a little tractor because I just kept going. You can take a pause, and that's fine too, but when you pause in that, you also are still in motion. Whether you pause in your step or just keep your body moving, in any case, the backward and the forward step are not separate. So it's an occasion for being present, moving in your body, undivided. All of that is what we're doing in Kin Hin. But of course we're silent, so I never say that. So. Rilke says, we turn even the young child around so she looks backward and sees only the forms we create, not the open, which is so deep in animals' eyes. So he's seeing this process of becoming an individual and educating ourselves, each other, being educated into a human life with a human mind as a backward emotion, backward away from unity into dividedness, into forms, separately created forms. And that's, in a sense, what, you know, one aspect of what goes on in our educating ourselves in life and each other in life. To find that other side where we are, when we look backward, we look backward at the fact that we have been doing this all our lives and that that's not all we are and all we're doing. So it's not just following thoughts or letting them go, it's seeing your life happening. Seeing the form and box creating activity, seeing it in its beauty and its terror and its emptiness. That's what emptiness is, a very powerful idea. Mm-hmm. Saying that we can create a form, but to say it is empty is to say it is not absolute as it is. It's a dance. It's a swirl. It's a coming together for now of a certain set of features that I will provisionally call a thing. And you could have another set and not see that one thing. It's very difficult to do this while using words because there's the words. So we can do it with words, but we have to also have a way of approaching this activity of the mind, the form creating and the emptiness of those forms underneath words, and that's Zazen is one of the great ways to do that. And the very fact that we say, you don't know what you're doing in Zazen, forget about all these words. As Katagiri once said, you know, please shut up and sit down. I think he was talking to me. He's talking to all of us, certainly to me. So we do a Zazen that is that. We will remember that that's our activity. Our great activity is to please shut up and sit down. Well, he said it with kindness. A very kind man. Rilke goes on to say, the animals are free from death. We alone can see death. For the animals, their death is, as it were, completed behind them. What's ahead is God. And when they move, already in eternity, they move in timelessness like a fountain, or we might say like a spring. He sees the animal as free from death, as something separate from life, whereas we, with our sense of past, present, and future, and change and impermanence, see death. Fear death, maybe even long for death, which is really not so different from, that's maybe fearing life. So he sees the animals as free from death because they don't, essentially because they don't have a distinct past and a future and a sense of a future of impermanence. Now, there are exceptions, and, you know, the crows that save up for the breakfast, and few animals have some sense of that kind of self, and by and large it is people who have an awareness of a past, a future, and a sense of death as separate from life. And we suffer from that awareness. And yet, if we didn't have to be human, to live as a human, you absolutely need a sense of past, present, and future. That's without a mind that can do that, we would not thrive as individuals or as a species. It's natural to us. It's not wrong to have a sense of past, present, future, and death. But what we do with that, how we become this divided self, I'm here alive and death is my enemy. Or someone else's death is my enemy because I want them. My life is not complete without this other person, so they die. That's bad too. So death becomes this enemy. And the suffering that in our own body on the way to death is, it hurts like hell for the most part, is suffering. Obviously that's bad. So we get, there is this individual with its needs as well as its lusts, and there is a larger world that we have great difficulty understanding ourselves to be part of. Putting those two together, it's very difficult for the individual mind, and yet it's already the case. See, Rilke says, never, not for a single day, do we have before us space so unbounded that the blooming of one flower is forever. Well, yeah, because he's already existing within a world of a single day, of a day. When we live in time, we can't really be timeless. While he's caught in time, saying, a day, not even for a day. Well, the universe doesn't have a clock, doesn't have a day, a night, a unit called that. So whenever we're in a unit of, this is my day, and this is me, we're not going to be in an unbounded universe. And yet if we tried to live only in an unbounded universe, it wouldn't work. You have to be able to distinguish a green light from a red light, the curb from the street, to even just get home today. Zazen is generally done with eyes open, and the gaze of Zazen, the fact that the person doing Zazen is gazing, is having a gazing, not looking. When we start out there, we do a lot of looking, and so there's a little homunculi in the wall waving back at us. We see people, things. Usually that goes away after a while. Your mind just gets tired of it. can take years, but mine gets tired. But rather than close the eyes and have an exclusively inward, backward focus, which is a fine thing to do, in Zazen, we're turning inward and outward at the same time. That's this being present here and now. There is a stepping back. We're not running around doing a lot of things, except maybe in our heads while we're sitting Zazen. And then we see ourselves doing it and say, no, that's not what this is about. So we are stepping out of some of the river of complication and accomplishment. We're not detaching from our lives. We can't. We're not trying to. Or from the world. And so that's another reason we sit with our eyes open, gazing into the open. Often a wall, because it's simpler. When we gaze out into the room, we can have a wider gaze in a sense, but we also have a very visually complex field, and it's very hard for the brain not to get caught up in that. Poor little brain, we want to give it a little bit of a rest. So we have a gaze, you gaze at your entire life and the entire world facing a white wall. Also, you at some point you say, wait a minute, here I am staring at a white wall, I'm not choosing from the menu at the restaurant. This is what my mind thinks of doing. This is the contrast between the mind's busyness and the simplicity of the visual field can sometimes be very helpful. But we're gazing. We're actually gazing into the open, into our life, into what's here. And that gazing is part of the open posture of Zazen. Gazing like animals in Zazen, facing in or facing out. We're not looking at something. We're not creating an idea or a box or naming things that we see. We're not looking at, we're not analyzing, we're not synthesizing. We're gazing as part of creation, quite a part of life, endlessly creating in that sense of creation, as part of it. That's why we say being present here and now. We are part of the fullness of life as ourselves, gazing into the open. It's a grand practice. And it's hard. We don't naturally want to sit down and do it because we naturally have this busy mind that says, you know, I've got 10 things to do right now. I don't really have time today for Zazen. Because that mind of doing is so powerful. We are so well constructed for it, so overly constructed for it and trained for it, that it's hard to remember the pleasure in dropping down from that. It's one of the great reasons that the human species goes, we go sort of lemming-like almost out to the edge of the sea and stare at the water. I love to do that. The waves or a stream. At Ty's place in Massachusetts, in the back of her property, there's a little stream called the Swift River. It does flow all year round. And you can go down and sit on a rock and just the gurgle and the movement of that is somehow that gives the mind enough to play with, but it's playing with something that it's part of, that it's relating to, and the oceans are the same. We're gazing then without a particular agenda. Some people do it in walking. Some do it in singing. And in Zazen, we do it with no particular object at all. That's why it's not called the concentration practice, although there is a samadhi, a concentration or settledness. But we're not looking at any one thing or two things. We have no particular object. Very satisfying and not always easy. Not easy, not hard. Easy and hard, you know, are one of the hallmarks of the divided self. I realized one day when I was finding life hard, difficult, that perception is hallmark of the divided self. I'm hard means I'm stuck with a sense of myself outside of this and marching along in relation to it, taking arms against a sea of troubles. And so therefore, just that experience of it's so hard, which we all know, is an expression, a reminder of, oh, I'm experiencing myself as divided. That's an experience I have. And then I can maybe remember at least up here somewhere or here, that it's not my whole self. That's not all of who I am. It's an experience I'm having. That's one of the prime flavors of feeling divided. Never, not for a single day, do we have before us space so unbounded that the blooming of one flower is forever. We're always making it world and never letting space be nothing. The pure, the unconstructed, which we breathe and endlessly know and do not crave. We do experience ourselves as divided. This is a true subjective experience. And it is operationally comes, we can see, from productively in our life and from the depths of our misconstructions that our minds also sets going. And this no practice is for something to do as a human being is going to, should or could or would, set you free from this divided self in such a way that you couldn't function. It's how do you live as a divided self and simultaneously as a not a divide, as an undivided self? How do you live at once in the universe and in yourself? How do we do that? How do we do that even though pretty much for the most part when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark? Even the going back and forth between, oh, here's the time of zazen or sesshin, I feel, or being at the beach or making love or whatever it is that is clear and unifying, it seems to be set apart from and against the time when we are busy and divided. Even then, we're still oscillating in a divided way. So we want to find a way both to understand the divided self in a productive way and as it's suffering, find our way to understand and to experience ourselves undivided, and then what do we do about this alternating at best between divided and undivided? Divided is good, divided is bad, undivided, divided. We always seem to be doing that back and forth. And that's where I'm going to leave it.